Hello, I'm Simon Burton, and welcome to Arts Roundup, a show that takes us into an artist's Ice Cube studio space to see her work, gets to grips with sculpture that is wet, and hears of a famous Cambridge Scientific tale retold in a play with a brand new slant. In this edition, artist Chloe Leeper talks on her drawing and latest sculptural work at Changing Spaces in Norfolk Street. We preview the forthcoming Art Language Location Festival with artists Robert Good, Sue Shepherd and Susie Olchak. Art conservator Penny Heath explains why her annual Art In and Out of the Garden event has become a key fixture on the local arts calendar. Playwright Rani Drew appeals for actors in her new and topical play on Crick and Watson's discovery of the DNA double helix and a very special woman's contribution behind the research. And we look forward to November's Cambridge Christmas exhibition with local painter Joe Tumner. Watching a piece of sculpture actually being made as it happens by a working artist isn't something you get to see that often in Cambridge, but if you've been down Norfolk Street just lately, you may have noticed an Ice Cube window setup provided in what used to be the Ark, a completely whitened gallery space in which interesting things are going on before your eyes. I dropped in on Changing Spaces artist in residence, Chloe Leeper, who's been building what I would describe as a visual mesh or grid sculpture with diagonally posited wire lines suspended in the air against a corner space with a corresponding hand-drawn backdrop that simply had to be investigated because it's so strange, complex and wonderful. Chloe, you've got some fantastic things on display here, which we're going to talk about. But first of all, tell me a bit about yourself. You studied in Cambridge originally, didn't you?
Yes, I grew up in Cambridge. So I did my foundation at CRC, and then after that got onto a course in London, and I've only just moved back to Cambridge, having completed my MA at City & Guilds. So I've just come back, and this is a very lucky first opportunity for me.
But you've done lots of exciting things in the past. Yes. I know that you've been head of the foundation at the Art Academy in London, that you're also a senior lecturer at the Inchbold School of Design in London.
Yeah.
And also you regularly lecture at the British Museum. What do you do there?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to be asked back a number of times to do different workshops based on various different exhibitions that they have themed at the time. So lots of clay portraiture when they had the Roman portraiture exhibition, a frieze workshop when they had something to do with friezes, and I've also been on the very energy-sapping British Museum sleepovers, running four workshops an evening with 40 kids ago.
A sleepover?
I didn't sleep over. I was allowed to go home at 12, which was nice.
That sounds like a wonderful project. Okay, we've come to have a look at some of your work here, which is displayed as some wonderful black and white. Would you call them drawings, your paintings?
I think that's the territory that overall they would fit into, because they're primarily about spatial delineation, and that really is the language that is most found and concentrated and concerned within drawings theory. So actually, yeah, there are some obviously direct drawings, and then the installations show the drawings sort of effectively coming off the wall in three-dimensional linear elements.
But they have lots and lots of very closely associated lines in them that have sort of different degrees of depth and what have you.
Yeah.
And obviously you're showing these paintings which have a very, you know, visually very interesting, because they have depth in the space and they have lots of striking shapes in them. But it's really about a certain area of consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it, actually. Yeah.
And what is the original idea behind them? Because Plato's study of forms were part of it, weren't they?
Yeah, it basically, it's been about the last 3 years, there's been a number of different sort of ideas that I've been looking into and coming across that actually have all sort of fed into this, rather than this being didactically about a certain theme. So Plato, certainly, the theory of forms postulating that there are, like many religions and philosophies actually, postulating that there is the ideal realm, which is also the case within mathematics, for instance, this ideal mathematical abstract realm that you can only ever get rough approximation. So everyone has a notion of what a perfect circle is, but of course a real perfect circle can't ever exist. So I was quite interested in the relationship between those levels of perfection and imperfection as being the temporal experience of, well, one of the temporal experiences of being human, I suppose. So it's something that's quite, you know, quite interesting to most people. And then other things, lots of references. I'm also very interested, having taught architectural theory for a number of years, and that really, because of the connections with space and spatial psychology, that really informs my work, both in the visual language, but also in the feeling and the experience of space as being something that's actually quite fractured, because it's you move through space. You don't stand and get a whole sense of something. That only happens on architect's drawings, you know.
It's sort of two-dimensional things and three-dimensional things, and then things that cross over from the abstract conscious mind into real space as well.
Well, actually, one of the things that kind of spurred all this theoretical endeavour has actually been my personal experience of the often disconnection between mental space and consciousness and positing yourself in the external world, and actually that being quite a difficult translation sometimes, for me anyway. And so that led me to I suppose, discover a lot of these theories that dealt with this experience in different ways.
Leading in here to describe to our listeners, in the shop there's this absolutely fantastic sculpture which is in 3D, which has a backdrop of white walls with lots of lines at various angles, and then coming out from that you have suspended in the air lots and lots of grey lines which correspond with them, and it's also offered a diagonal in one corner, which makes it quite spectacular visually. And you've used the whole room to do that. This must have taken you hours.
It did. It took about building the wall as well. It took about 5 weeks, I suppose, because the drawing itself on the back wall, because I like to continually be interested and challenged in my work, and if I was going to have planned out the installation exactly and then just built it, I don't learn as much as if I know roughly the area in which I'm working and then develop it. So the first 3 weeks of that build were quite nerve-wracking, as you see something come into life and keep that dialogue with it, so that you're not saying this is what I'm going to make. You're looking and keeping that very connected.
So you can't actually plan it. You just have to build it when you've got the space.
Yeah, I knew how I was going to do it, but I couldn't say for certain exactly how it would look. But I knew. I think you have to retain, although the visual language was quite established through the drawings. I developed that. You had to retain a sort of an overall sort of feeling, atmosphere, kind of temperature that you were aiming for, and that was the governing thing. And you know, if you're hitting that's the main thing. That's what's going to affect people.
Now that's in the drawings that you have in black and white, but also the sculpture is like a kind of interface, isn't it? That shows you that whole process of going from abstract things to concrete things in real space. So you've explored the reality that we actually live within, but don't actually notice, if you see what I mean. You've created something, a piece of art that kind of expresses that. And that must have been quite a difficult thing to get your head around, to be able to do that.
Yeah, well, I suppose it was because my head was like that. This is what my mind looks like. So I think, actually, it's a really succinct way of putting it. And that certainly was what I was aiming for. And I think that the best you can do, obviously as an artist, most people, you're making art because it's your vision of the world. That's why you're not just representing. You're kind of, this is sort of how I understand things to be. And this is how space feels for me. And for, you know, and
it's also that kind of tunnel between the waking and sleeping world. Is that a space that you try to occupy as well?
It's a very fragmented time. And actually, to the beginning of the installation, when it was completely in my mind all of the time, just before I was going to sleep, I would get flashes of this kind of linear patterning in my mind just as I was going, because it was so, it felt so much like that little transition where you go from the logic of consciousness into the, you know, the abstract surrealist world of dreams, and you're just at that beginning where consciousness is breaking its rationale. So yes, I think that's probably a good...
Do you find it terribly exciting when you actually create a piece of art like this that really does capture what you're after, basically?
Which of course you can only, in one sense, you can only really know when you get feedback from people. But I mean, to me, I got to a state with it where it did what I wanted for me, and then you just have to see. And luckily I've had we've had, Angie and I at this exhibition have had some amazingly informed, articulate, not necessarily informed in terms of being artists or anything, but just people that were very aware, very engaged with observation, and and could articulate this. So we've had some, you know, I've had some great feedback that shows that this has achieved, for at least a number of people, this has achieved what I was hoping to sort of bring to people's attention, I suppose.
And obviously another influence on this has been Eve Lomax. Now, how does that tie in with this?
She was somebody I discovered in when I was on my MA course at Sitting Guilds, and she's a wonderfully poetic writer. And the thing that I was finding hard is that when I was writing my thesis at the time, I was dealing with a lot of very heavy theory, talking about trialectic space and the breakdown of the Descartesian dualism of mind and body, and it was going into very heavy, I enjoy philosophy, but it was stretching me. And actually I was recommended by my tutor to read a passage of Eve Lomax, and what was so wonderful is because of her poeticism, she was dealing with some of these ideas, or at least I drew parallel with these ideas, but because of the way she expressed herself, I could feel it. So rather than being, you know, the physics of how spatial perceptions work, or certain philosophers who were very, very rational and very obtuse for me, I found somebody that expressive of the ideas for me in my interpretation of them. And so that poeticism, and particularly because I am interested in words, and words help me in the kind of the resonance and the emotive quality of words, I found that actually some of her phrases and the way that she was talking with space and, well, happenings and events happening that I interpreted as being in space, that I was able to get much more of this important abstract emotive grasp of what I was trying to do.
I read in your bio there's a quotation from her: "The noise that sounds the restless and multiplicity of the world."
See, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
She's, I think when you read something like that after you've had a lot of people just talking quite straightly about multiplicity and singularity, to read that and even the rhythm of it, because I come from a musical background, and I think that is kind of quite important in your choice of structuring, particularly time-based, spatial-based media. And I think that comes through with her words so strongly that it really helped, actually, the development of my language, her verbal language, actually helped develop my conceptual ideas, but also helped develop my visual language.
When is your next exhibition coming up, and where is it?
The next exhibition will actually be here, which is wonderful. Angie was very kind to, again, offer me a sort of a residency project-based exhibition, because this was so successful, particularly this idea of the glass cube, whereby people can see the piece being made.
Please.
So they, and I have had a lot of people come and say, "Oh, I've been watching this thing," which is great, because that's sort of what you want. So that although you have maybe a lot of this theory, that it's more about the experience. Often you are faced with walking into a space and it's just there. Whereas I think the work is very experiential. Like I say, although it comes from a theoretical, strong theoretical background, it's about just experiencing. You don't need to have read any of that, you know, to get it. So I think that I've been very lucky again to have been offered the space over the Christmas, so no holiday for me. But I'm going to rework and redevelop a piece that I did called The Murmuring Corner, which references Lomax's language of the murmuring, the murmuring multiples. And that's going to be much more immersive, and that will be in around the second week of January. It will open for a couple of weeks.
So changing spaces has been really important for you then?
Absolutely.
As an artist.
Absolutely. Fantastic. It's amazing, particularly as an installationist, to have the opportunity, because even as an installationist with the type of work I do, getting the build time is very difficult. And that was one of the ideas for having this glass cube project space, is that in a way that although my exhibiting time is lessened, people get to see the make. So the gallery isn't sort of shut up for 5 weeks. It's still able to somehow have a life. It's still able to go on. And luckily, Angie invited me back to work with her in a joint exhibition, which will open in January. So I'll build another immersive installation this time. And that will be from January the 11th until January the 19th, with the private view on the night of the 11th.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. A new festival concerned with art, language and a rationale for the particular public space it occupies kicks off this October with exhibitions in venues across the city. Art, Language, Location brings together 40 artists from the city who will create artworks in public spaces that explore ideas of text and place, following on from last year's popular Text and Context series. The collaboration's essentially been founded by former Cambridge School of Art artists and is currently linked to the forthcoming Cambridge University Festival of Ideas, bringing together the necessary resources needed to stage public artwork in the city, and it now has its own online resources and networking hub designed to make things happen on shoestring budgets, and perhaps with a spot of help from the City Council. Here's artist founder Robert Good with Sue Shepherd, an artist working with neon signage, and artist Susie Olchak, who also works with light. Robert, you're doing all kinds of interesting things in Cambridge at the moment, which we've kind of come to talk about. But just to talk a little bit about your past, you're someone who's involved in lots of arts things here, and you were winner of the Searle Award for creativity.
Well, I was studying at Anglia Ruskin University at the Cambridge School of Art and did a Master of Fine Art, and as part of that there was a Searle Award competition, and I constructed a great big installation with Twitter feed and printer and so on the theme of crisis, and they seemed to like it, so that was good for me.
Last time I spoke to you guys, you were doing text and context, which was a series of things that were going on in the city. How did that project pan out in the end?
It was great. No, it was actually last October, and it went very well, and it was the kind of forerunner for what we're doing this year. In fact, at the time we said, oh, we'll never do that again. It was so much work, so much effort, you know, but in fact we enjoyed it and we wanted to do it again and to build on it, really.
The whole thing of the exhibition was that you had a location that was quite prevalent in the actual work itself. I had chosen Reality Checkpoint as the piece that I wanted to be next to, and that's henceforth the You Are Here, but it had a lot bigger meaning than that. But it was quite a challenge to do it, but it was fun, really good fun to do.
And you've worked with people like film director Ridley Scott on projects in the past, haven't you? Are you doing anything with him at the moment?
No, not at all. I've worked on a lot of commercials with him in the 80s, and that was fun too.
Dizzy, what brings you here today? Is it part of Art Language Location? Are you doing a particular project?
I'm here kind of, I'm doing the publicity for Art Language Location and helping on the organisational team, so helping Robert to put everything together. And I'm also doing a collaborative piece with Sue for Art Language Location this year.
And is this again ideas of art, text and place?
I think so, yes. We wanted to kind of bring it all together with a linking idea, which is text and language and its relationship to art and so on. So all of the artworks have got some sort of link to language. But over and above that, we wanted people to place their artworks in a space that is sympathetic to the work. So everybody has to go out and find a space dotted around Cambridge that fits their work.
Okay, tell me a bit about Art Language Location. It's a new website. It seems to be plugged into lots and lots of different things. What was its purpose and how did it come into being?
Well, it just kind of grew like Topsy, really. We wanted to try and get all the artists on the website, and the number of artists involved kind of kept growing, and it's been a collaborative project in that we've kind of had to get locations, we've had to get people to help us, and so every time somebody comes on board on the project, we add them onto the website and link them in. So we're all linked in together and try and, you know, use that as the main way in which people can find out about the project.
Your partner organisations are people like Aidan the Beck, Kettle's Yard, Cambridge School of Art and various others. So can you give me an example of some of the things that you're actually doing in those locations and how those partnerships work?
Well, one of them that we've got, the Festival of Ideas, we're doing some work on the Sidgwick site, which is Sidgwick Avenue, and got about 8 or 9 artists who are working on locations around that site, and that's been facilitated by the university, who've been really helpful with us. But then, for example, there's a bookshop called Plurabelle Books on the Homerton Business site, and somebody's painting a new mural for us on the side of the wall there. So lots of interesting things going on.
And you also have a connection with Askance Publishing, don't you?
Indeed, yes. That's Caroline Jane, and she publishes some books, and she very kindly published one of mine a little while ago.
So you're bringing together writers, organisations and artists to do specific things. Can you tell me a bit about your project?
We're working on a neon installation that's going to be exhibited just near Magdalen Bridge in the city centre. It's going to be abstract version of the word reflect, and the idea is that it reflects into the Cam and the river, and the viewer can read the text within the river. So we're kind of busy making the frame and sorting out all the neon and working out the logistics for installing a piece of the
So it's neon, shivering water, reflections. It sounds as though it's like part of the Illuminate Festival of Light. Is there a connection with that as well? Because that's coming up again, isn't it, quite soon?
That's in February.
In February, yeah.
Yeah, it's something that we're both involved in as well, so it does have its connections.
Now, with the Festival of Ideas, which of course is just about to come round again, what's your connection there? What happens with that?
Well, they've been really helpful in helping us to find some locations, and they've got a main open day on the 26th of October on the Sidgwick site, and part of that, we've got some performances, and we've got a pop-up gallery, and we've got a little shop all around that people could come and visit. So we've got events on all day.
So the concept with what you do, basically, is that if you're an artist and you're coming into the Cambridge scene and you have some idea of what you want to do, your organisation basically helps people fit them with the right place and the right contacts and what have you to make it work quickly.
It's a very collaborative project. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of forming partnerships. You know, we don't have a lot of funding, we don't have a lot of money to spare, but it's a matter of just having conversations with people, finding venues and owners who are interested in working with us, hosting an artwork, which for them can be exciting as well as for the artists, and making some connections that way. And we're raising funds for Oxfam, a little charity partnership, so we'd like to raise some funds. So artists are donating postcards for sale in the Oxfam shop, and we're also raising funds during the course of the exhibition. But for example, Barefoot Wines are providing the wine for our opening event free of charge, so that will enable us to raise some funds for Oxfam on their behalf. So that's a really important benefit for us. And Travis Perkins have provided some materials. Outspoken Cycles are doing an advert on the side of their cycles going around Cambridge. Mm. So lots of nice little hookups where, you know, they can help us out, and in return we can provide them with a little bit of artwork.
What are the new and emerging writers in your project doing at the moment, and what's coming up that you might be able to preview for us as things that people might...
Well, we've got some really, really interesting ones this year. It is fascinating to see how all the kind of creativity and the different people's ideas come about. One that's really nice is going to be taking place in the window of the Christian Science Reading Room on Regent Street. And that all came about because the artist, Teresa Harrison, found some letters that had been discarded, and she was curious as to what the correspondence was all about, and she traced all the way back to this lady who used to volunteer for Christian Science, and it turns out that the people who are based there now remembered her. So she's doing a whole exhibition around these lost letters that have been found. It's going to be in the window there, so that'll be a nice one for people to see. And we've got some postcards that are going to be going in some newsagents' windows, some Lonely Hearts adverts with a twist, all that.
Now you're doing things with light. Obviously lots of other cities in Europe do this, especially in places like Italy, but to come to a place like Cambridge and do it, you have fantastic backdrops to do those things in. Is that a really special opportunity for you as an artist?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting city to work. So I did a piece last year in the grounds of Senate House, a lighting piece, and that was a really incredible space to be doing a piece of artwork. And I think that's what's special about Art Language Location as a festival, is it gives artists opportunities to work in places they wouldn't normally consider for an artwork. So we're doing art pieces that aren't in galleries and that are in kind of everyday spaces in shops.
I've noticed when walking around in places like Venice, you know, you notice a passageway and suddenly it's full of shoes that go on for hundreds of yards and things like that. And Cambridge is becoming more like that, isn't it? Because, you know, when you walk around, you don't realise that people are starting to really use the public spaces to do things like that. And it is actually a big change in the city, especially in the evenings, isn't it? Because it's making it much more culturally interesting. And this website seems to be a good touch point for all of that.
I think that's definitely true. I think what's interesting is that Cambridge is becoming more an arts venue where more is happening, and that's really encouraging and really exciting. Yeah, definitely. And it's not just Cambridge artists who are doing Art Language Location, but we've got artists from across the UK, people coming from Liverpool and Sussex and Darlington, and from abroad as well. So we're bringing other new artists into Cambridge as well, which is great for us to...
It's a new and exciting arts hub on the internet. It's called Art Language Location. Is it .com or
.org?
.org. Artlanguagelocation.org. Take a look at it if you've got any interest in the arts in Cambridge. Thank you all very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Every garden has its own tale to tell in this extraordinary city of ours, but few can compete with that of art conservator Penny Heath when she stages her annual Art In and Out of the Garden event. You might think that when over 200 local academics, art buffs and artists themselves are invited to enjoy a pick of the region's sculptures in a spacious garden, and inside view paintings and ceramics, that a spot of rain might spoil the ambience, but quite the opposite turns out to be true. A huge bank of umbrellas wait in kind anticipation with the wine, and a series of fire baskets light up the scene, putting a whole new flickering visual slant on the remarkable work on display. Penny introduces a show which also raises funds for cancer support charity Maggie's Wallace at Addenbrookes Hospital.
Well, I call it my day job, but I'm actually a paper conservator, which means I restore and conserve works of art on paper, which is very exacting, and I, you know, work in my studio looking after other people's works of art. And I suppose the essence of this show is that it's the contrast, it's me being allowed to be creative.
This is the absolutely classic archetypal British event. It's beautifully laid out in your garden here in Wilberforce Road. Lots of wonderful sculptures to look at, fires in various quarters of the garden to warm people, lots of wine and things like that, but of course it's pouring with rain. Do you think that bothers people much in Cambridge?
Well, I think this is absolutely fascinating, and I think it's, you know, one could be sort of pretentious and say it's the power of beauty and art, but it is something about the show. People say it's the highlight of the year, and I think they love the informality of it, and I think it's the fact it's a domestic environment, and we're showing art, but we don't even mention the word sale. It's here for pleasure, for enjoyment. There's wit, there's beauty, there's harmony, and the fact that people are prepared to come out on a rain with a weather front forecast.
You've provided a huge bank of umbrellas so that people can have umbrellas as they walk around. Can you take me on a quick tour around the garden? What is there to see this year?
Interesting. Well, there is a rather beautiful garden with its September plantings, but we've also got about 20 artists, some who've shown before, some who haven't, and we've got an extraordinary range of kinetic sculptures, which are very eye-catching and subtle. There's a wonderful stone vessels made by somebody who's really a dry stone waller and made this extraordinary, can't describe it, satisfying shapes, but very grounded. We have a lot of welded metal work.
Those are very interesting. That's kind of drawing in the air with metal. Which sculptor did those?
Yes, someone called Melissa Pierce-Murray, who we haven't shown before. Her art is one of those things that you get drawn in at many levels. To begin with, you just see an outline, you think that's interesting, and then you realise that she's actually almost like, if you like, drawing with metal, making outlines of figures. But she's also very involved with sort of dance and movement. In fact, one of her figurative pieces, she's been asked to join up with a choreographer because they're so interested in the sort of solidity of this form. It's hard to explain without seeing it.
But they're great to encounter in a garden space like this. They're very much an outdoor thing. And also these enormous and what look like huge bird's nests.
Yes.
In Kane, whose are those?
Yes, those are one. That's an artist called Sue Kirk, who I think she's from Rutland Way, and she does this magic things with willow and turns sort of willow weaving basket onto a completely extraordinary scale. And as you say, they're enormous. They're sort of almost 2 meters high. She's a petite person. She rides this huge van, and you need two men to lift these pieces. They're willow woven around a metal frame. Willow's very robust, actually. Yeah. So although they're sitting under a willow tree looking stunning, you know, they'll last 5 years, and then she'll re-maintain it. She'll re-stitch them, if you like.
And there's one or two other things tucked away in some of the corners here. What are those?
Well, we've got some extraordinary work made by someone called Richard Bray, who does this wonderful work with wood. He finds sort of mulberry wood, and it might sit in the studio for 8 years, and just manages to carve. It's very intricate. It's very hard to explain, but there's so much going on, the sort of energy from carving and light and curves and folds, and they're mesmerising. They're absolutely mesmerising when the shadow falls on there.
And how do you decide what you're going to put in your show and what you're not going to put in?
That's getting more and more difficult because so many people would like to show with us. We are a bit selective, but I try to rotate it. We try to have a change of artists, introduce a couple of new people every year, and you know, we drop people 1 year and come back again. But actually, we're slightly victim of our own success. And I think my skill is placing things very well. I do this power of sort of harmony and balance. It's terribly important. It's really inside me, I internally and externally. That's why this garden is very interesting.
It's great to use a large space like this. But last year you had a wonderful shed with a camera box set up in it, which was lots of people enjoyed that. What are the highlights of this year?
Yes, I like that. I like to do an installation, if you like, and actually commission something. I probably haven't had quite the same focus of a singular installation, but there is. I mean, I think I've introduced the braziers tonight because of the fire. fire elements and the fire pits. It's very atmospheric. People have just loved it. I mean, the fact they're still here, I don't know, it's getting on for 9 o'clock at night, it's pouring with rain, it's dark.
And they're still wandering around and with their drinks, enjoying the sculptures by the firelight. Yes. Lovely. And who are the artists that are actually here this evening?
Well, do you know, it's such a long list, and I feel awful I started listing and leaving one out. But, you know, we've got Cambridge, there's Eric Marland, we have Richard Bray, Eve Corder. I mean, I'm going to leave somebody out, but the other thing I like I've done, because I love to help younger artists and people perhaps have been less fortunate. And you know, I say social benefits, but it's good. And I have two fantastic people who help me in the garden. And, you know, one cuts my grass and one, you know, mends things for me. And they've both got works here because they're artists, they're craftsmen. And there's a fantastic bench, which we've actually sold three. My lovely man, Dragan Chorovic, has made this very elegant bird bath. And in fact, I all sound pretentious, but I only have artists working in my garden. But people respond to it. Everyone loves working here. They work with me.
What an exciting event. Penny Heath, thank you very much indeed for inviting me to your Art in the Garden event. It's really wonderful.
It's a pleasure, and it's such fun having you. Thank you.
Thank you.
The story of unravelling the mystery of DNA and how it passes genetic traits from one generation to another by Cambridge scientists Crick and Watson in the 1950s has been featured on TV lately, and particularly their legendary victory roll pint of beer at the Eagle Pub in Bennett Street on the day of the breakthrough discovery of the molecular structure of DNA, the double helix. The subject has been debated hotly in Cambridge University halls recently, and there's an angle which hasn't been fully aired from the history books. It led a local feminist playwright to create a new three-act play due to be staged later in the year. Cambridge playwright and writer Rani Drew's new play, The Unsung Heroine of DNA, tells the story of Rosalind Franklin, without whose research contribution the breakthrough Crick and Watson made might never have been achieved. A brand new play, it's called The Unsung Heroine of DNA?
Yes.
So you've based your play against this true life backdrop.
Yes.
And what inspired you to create a play from this story? I mean, had you been reading about it anyway and just got caught up in it?
Well, what happened was many, many years ago, there was a call from one of the groups, and I think it may have been Right On, that called for six playwrights to write six parts of the double helix announcement in the Eagle Pub. And this was, I think it must have been on the 50th anniversary or something like that. So it wasn't that long ago then. And so I was one of the six people. But a neighbor of ours, she told me that she had a disease which she inherited from her mother, and her mother inherited from her. So I brought that in, and I brought in the announcement at the Eagle, and I wrote just the first part. But they didn't go along with that. So that was waiting. And when in March I read this piece, Rosalind Franklin was a Newnham College student. She was a biology and chemistry, and you know, you do everything. And the Newnham College people decided in the 60th anniversary, which is this year, to put up a plaque for her also. So when I read this paper, I thought, ooh, you know, this has come back. So I wrote a 15-minute long play about putting this together with my way back play also. And then I thought, after sort of, you know, July, I thought, well, maybe I should write a longer play. So I went out and I booked the hall, which is the English department studio. And then I said, well, I must write that now. And it, you know, for 3 weeks, I was just non-stop writing this play.
What is the basic plot? Because I gather it's about the race to completing the DNA project, but it's riddled with a story of deceit and cunning.
Yes. Well, Rosalind Franklin was only, I think she was only 30 years old when she came to Cambridge. She died at the age of 37 in 1958. So she was very young. She had been working, first she worked on coal virus in Kingston. Then she had a job in Paris. And then she thought she'd come and do this work on the DNA or the double DNA structure. So she came here. Now she was very French in terms of, you know, the way she looked at people and looked at life and enjoyment and other things. And she found King's College very sort of, you know, tight and stiff upper lip and other things. But she was only concerned with her work. But there was already another research scholar by the name of Morris Wilkins. And she was to work, I mean, she thought she was being called to do separate work. But then he thought that she was going to work with him as a research scholar, i.e. under him. So she was very uptight and she wouldn't put up with any nonsense. So she ticked him off. And so the relationship, you know, were very rocky right from the beginning. And then, of course, in Cambridge, in Cavendish Lab, Watson was just very ambitious. And he would come to King's College and say, what's happening here and this and that. And because Wilkins wasn't getting on with, they did get on at the beginning and they would go and have lunch together. I mean, it was a very different world. At King's, there was no, the high dining hall, high table dining hall, no women were allowed. And she was the only one in the lab, although there were 8 female scientists in the whole science lab in King's College of Rosalind Franklin. And it all came to a head in 1962 when they were awarded the Nobel Prize, and no mention was her of hers was made. So people say that this is not the way science research should be done.
So you're auditioning for actors at the moment. That's why you're here today.
I am, absolutely. Absolutely. I need 6 male actors to play the roles of 6 scientists, male scientists. They are, you know, they make history. So that, and then 1 woman.
When are the auditions, first of all, and where are they?
The auditions are at the end of September, the last weekend, which is Saturday 28th and Sunday 29th. And it's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then it is in October also, the following week, early October, Saturday 5th and Sunday 6th, from the same time, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. The place is 9 West Road, Cambridge. It is the English department of Cambridge University, and it's called Judith E. Wilson Studio, Faculty of English, 9 West Road, Cambridge. And my telephone number for any inquiries is 01223-368-231. And my email is rdrew@waitrose.com. So if people could send inquiries to my email, then I will send them the written, you know, audition times and place. And I will also send them a synopsis and summary of the play.
Ronnie Drew, thank you very much indeed. If you fancy a refreshing burst of new contemporary oil paintings, colourful prints and eye-catching ceramics, you might be tempted into the Unitarian Church in the city centre on November the 25th. 16 local artists are presenting an exhibition, Cambridge Christmas, in its 6th year, and encourages people to take in some mulled wine and contemplate giving something a bit different this Christmas, or simply take a look and talk to the artists about their work. Cambridge painter and printmaker Joe Tumner is exhibition organiser. Here we are in a wonderfully bright and spacious house surrounded by all of your wonderful artwork. Tell me a little bit about yourself, because originally you trained at the London College of Furniture and then at Cambridge School of Art, didn't you?
That's right, yeah. Yes. That's right. It seems a long time ago now, but yes.
Your paintings actually, so I'm told, are quite well known in Cambridge, and also something that many people may have seen on the stairwells of Addenbrooke's Hospital. How did they come to be there?
I did a show with Addenbrooke's Arts in the corridors in 2010, I think it was now, and it was received very well. So I was then commissioned by Charitable Trust to produce 3 artworks for the stairwells. So, and what I love about them is that they're not necessarily in your face. You might, if you pop up into the stairwells, you'll suddenly see them. And people still contact me now to say how lovely and what a surprise they were and how much they cheer them up. I'm known as a landscape painter, and I've recently gone into printmaking. So it really is about where I've been. And then I come back to the studio and I start painting. However, my printmaking is based solely on Cambridge City and at the moment Oxford City. I'm looking at those two cities in particular.
That's quite a recent departure for you. I mean, I'm looking at some of your prints, wonderfully colourful scenes from Cambridge. You've just been exhibiting in Oxford as well, haven't you?
That's right. I've just literally yesterday come back from a show at Oxford University for the whole weekend, for the alumni weekend. So it's been constant, non-stop work, but it's great. It's great fun and they've been well received. So
your landscapes use almost electrically bright colours to give you a real burst of colour, and yet they also have this kind of ambiguous distant form thing in them. What is it that you try to do with them?
What comes up for many times from customers who buy my work is that they love the fact that they can look into one of my paintings and think, well, where's it going? Yeah. What's in the background? And I think that's really what sums me up, you know, what I try and achieve in all my work and what and my events is that you don't quite know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And I suppose that really is runs through all of my work. So when you look at an oil painting of mine in the landscape, you're looking, oh, what is that in the distance? I'm not quite sure.
And you're using the viewer's imagination in a way to fill in the rest, aren't you?
That's
creates
right.
a bond between the person who's looking at the painting and the painting itself. Because
absolutely.
What's left out, you fill in with your own mind, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I often don't say titles are very important in your work. Yeah. And so I'll often not say this is Norfolk or whatever. It's very much about questioning the viewer's mind.
We're here to talk about an exhibition coming up on the 25th of November called Cambridge Christmas, which
That's
is
right.
at the Unitarian Church behind Emmanuel College. This house was actually, it's in its sixth year now, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And this house was actually the birthplace of that event. Can you tell me how it all began?
Well, we lived in California, Southern California, for several years, and it was quite a thing where a group of us would gather for the odd evening to showcase our work, invite the neighbours, invite friends, invite colleagues, and really showcase and sell our work in a sort of unusual but friendly, warm environment. And when we came back, I decided to try and recreate that here, but on a larger scale. And so I invited 9 of my friends, artists, painters, jewellers, ceramicists, to come and show in my house. And we decked it out in fairy lights and made mulled cider. We produced professional cards that we posted through all our local streets. And so it was so unusual at that time that people came. And because you came around the corner and the house was all lit up with fairy lights, and I do remember one little girl walking past saying, oh my goodness, that's the Las Vegas of Cambridge. It really did. It was like a Belisha beacon. And because we live in a cul-de-sac, it really was quite spectacular. And it was so successful. We had people queuing out into the street that I thought, okay, it's something special here.
It's only in Cambridge that you can do things in that
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely, and I love about Cambridge is it's full of independent makers, and you never quite know what's around the corner.
Okay, so there's 16 local artists exhibiting. Can you tell me a little bit? Is Katharina Klug from the Anglian Potters, is she exhibiting there as well?
Yep, Katharina is. This will be her third year with us. So I sometimes invite people back, and for a couple of years, 2-3 years, sometimes there's new ones each year. But Katharina will be her third year, and she's got a wonderful range, as usual, that you'll find. And along with the other ceramicists, there's Rachel Dormer, who is another fantastic ceramicist based in Cambridge, who's known for her more retro work. Then we have Amanda McPhail, who designs quirky, fun, lively pieces. So they're the three ceramicists we have.
Okay, so that's the 25th of November from 1 o'clock onwards at the Unitarian Church behind Emmanuel College. It looks like it's set to be an absolutely fabulous event. Joe Tumner, thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge 105.
It's time to take a look at a brief pick of what's coming up in the city in the coming weeks. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is staged as a live radio show at the Corn Exchange on Friday, October the 4th, with stars from the original radio and TV casts, including Simon Jones as Arthur Dent. Kettle's Yard is currently running a new photographic exhibition entitled Objects in the Field, featuring the work of artist Sophie Rickett, with an astronomy theme based around the work of scientist Dr. Roderick Wilstrop, which runs through until the 3rd of November. Cambridge Classical Concert Series kicks off on October the 17th with Tchaikovsky's Symphony Orchestra of Moscow Radio at the Corn Exchange, featuring Beethoven, Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky scores. And that brings us to the end of this programme, and I hope you enjoyed listening into Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105. Send us details of your creative project if you'd like to.